Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Call me Ishmael. This is Soundcheck. Actually, I'm Joel Meyer, in today for John Schaefer. Today, our series Music by the Book continues as we look at why Herman Melville's classic Moby Dick has inspired classical composers, rappers, Led Zeppelin, and one very determined Brooklyn schoolteacher. And later, we'll hear a live performance from the young singer and fiddler, Kendall Carson. But first, the Japanese composer Toru Takemitsu is just one of the many composers and songwriters who have mined the 1851 novel Moby Dick for great music. You're hearing a movement called Moby Dick from a Takemitsu work called Toward the Sea. Today we'll look at other musicians who have gone on their own hunt for the great white whale, including a Brooklyn school teacher who's writing one song for every chapter in the book. I should add here that there are 135 chapters in the book, and that's not counting the epilogue. But first, let's find out why musicians are so drawn to Moby Dick. Nathaniel Philbrick is the author of the book In the Heart of the Sea, about the true story of a whale ship disaster that inspired Moby Dick. He joins me by phone from Nantucket, the very same place that the whale ship Pequod set sail in Moby Dick. Welcome to Soundcheck, Nathaniel.
It's great to be here.
So more than 150 years after Herman Melville published Moby Dick, it's still inspiring music. Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, Moby Dick is a lot like the Bible. Melville put, it's not just the story of Ahab's demented quest for the white whale. It's really the story of the world, the universe. And I think anyone can find just about anything there. There's the mystery of the white whale. There's Ahab, you know, what is he about? And there's Ishmael, who is the narrator and just a real sort of likable sort. And it's just so much there that I think it will always be a source of inspiration.
It's inspired everything from comic books to movies, but, you know, we're concentrating on music today. What do you think that musicians or people that are creating, you know, classical works like the Takemitsu work that we just heard, we're going to hear rap music and rock music in just a little bit. What do you think the story holds inside of it for musicians?
Yeah, well, you know, I think a lot of that has to do with the ocean, the rhythms of the sea, and in fact, in Moby Dick, there are sea shanties that are a part of the whole plot and have been part of the movies that have been made about Moby Dick, and so there's a music to them. I mean, whales communicate through a song like chattering that at least sperm whales do, and so there are those kind of musical elements to it that. And there's a rhythmic quality to the sea that just makes it ready-made, I think, for some kind of musical treatment.
You know, we'll talk in a second about how not everybody has read Moby Dick and not everybody who has started Moby Dick has finished Moby Dick. So, but let's sort of talk about some of the basic themes that are in the book or sort of the basic story. It's really a story about obsession, one man's hunt to get even with the whale that bit off his leg. But also there are stories of friendship on board the Pequod, the crew that are a very tight bunch and have distinct characters. Do you think that obsession, friendship, those are themes that are going to call out to musicians?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting. The novel shifts as it goes along. In many ways, it begins sort of like a buddy flick. You've got Ishmael teaming up with Queequeg, you know, this most unlikely of pairings, a quote, cannibal from the South Sea Islands, teaming up with this inquisitive white guy in New Bedford, actually sleeping together.
They spend a night together.
They spend the night together,
right.
And it's a very modern story, and they're in a town, New Bedford, a whaling port that is sort of like the bar in Star Wars, you know, where every possible form of culture and life form is present, and so you just have this. It's sort of like jazz, New Orleans, you know, all these disparate cultural and social elements flinging on their way around, and so everyone is at sea, I think, in a very fundamental way, and then you have this intense loyal friendship springs up in the middle of all this. And so, you know, it begins in that kind of way. And then gradually do you get introduced to Ahab, that dark presence that remains off camera for so much of it, and then begins to take over the book.
You mentioned sort of a coming together of lots of different kinds of people, unlikely friendships. Multiculturalism is something that has been attached to Moby Dick in the last maybe 10 or 20 years as people have studied it. Was that something that was in Herman Melville's mind when he published the book in 1851?
Yeah, it was definitely in Herman Melville's mind, but it really wasn't in anybody else's mind. I mean, and that's one of the reasons why, you know, Moby Dick is this archetypal novel that we all, you know, either love or have to read. When it was published in 1851, it was a huge flop. No one quite knew what the heck he was talking about. It you know, did not fulfill your expectations for the conventions of that Victorian era. And because Melville had lived multiculturalism in his day, he had been, as a young man, he had shipped out on a whale ship out of New Bedford and spent a couple of years in the Pacific. He actually jumped ship in the Marquesas Islands, lived with the Typees, who were reputed to be cannibals, lived through that, came back, and, you know, he had firsthand had seen that there are all sorts of people and cultures around the world. And so this realization fired his imagination in ways that, you know, anticipate so much of the global environment we live in today, but which at the time when, you know, America was so fiercely jealous of its empire building and, you know, strutting onto that national stage, that, you know, we didn't really want to know what those other cultures were about. And so what Melville was saying was like really coming on deaf ears. But for us today, it's like, okay, this is the real juice that is making society and this global community work today.
I'm talking with the writer Nathaniel Philbrick. He's the author of the book In the Heart of the Sea, about a real-life whale ship tragedy that inspired Moby Dick. He also wrote a foreword to the 150th anniversary edition of Moby Dick. Nathaniel, we've been talking about multiculturalism and diversity as it relates to the text of Moby Dick. But the music that has been inspired by Moby Dick is also a very diverse bunch as well, too. We're going to hear a few different things that should illustrate that point. Now, one of the most familiar things, I think, to rock fans when they think Moby Dick, they're going to think of a track from Led Zeppelin II that became a very famous Led Zeppelin live moment. It's the drum solo, Moby Dick. John Bonham, the drummer for Led Zeppelin, performing Moby Dick. Now, if you saw this live, it might last anywhere from 4 minutes to maybe as long as 19 or 20 minutes. The other three members of the band would excuse themselves and go do something else for nearly 15 minutes and let John Bonham please the crowd. Another example of a Moby Dick-inspired work, the artist Laurie Anderson spent a large chunk of the 90s working on a performance piece based on the book. It's called Songs and Stories from Moby Dick. In the water, one white whale in all these oceans, one white whale. And then there's the case of MC Lars. On the 2006 album The Graduate, on this song called Ahab, He pretty much sums up the book.
With my worn down crew and my man Queequeg,
you're never gonna find him.
He's a big sperm whale.
The ocean is enormous.
Shut up, we're setting sail. This scar that you see that runs down my face has scarred my soul and inspired this chase. Mental sickness has got me on the run. Full speed ahead, this is American fun. There is wisdom that is woe, so welcome to my life. It was fine until Moby scarred me like a knife. Towards thee I sail, that unconquering whale, to stab my spear into your white tail. The first one to spot him gets his gold doubloon. Now excuse me while I go be melancholy in my room. Bad trip, thanks to Moby Dick. Egg leg, sperm whale, jawbone, what?
Can't stop messing my mind.
Whale crash, so fast. Oh no, oh no. The ship's got a hole, plug it up, plug it up.
We're never gonna find this white whale, are we, copy?
Hey, Ishmael.
MC Lars from the album The Graduate. That's called Ahab, summing up a big chunk of the book right there. Also, we heard from Laurie Anderson and Led Zeppelin, three very different examples of music inspired by Moby Dick. Let's bring in the composer Jake Heggie. He's currently adapting Moby Dick for an upcoming production at the Dallas Opera that will premiere in 2010. Jake, welcome back to Soundcheck.
Thanks. Nice to be here.
You have taken on a huge task of adapting a 500-plus page book into what might be like a three-hour opera.
That's
Why
correct.
Take on such a crazy task?
Well, it's like you said, I think when you take on a project like that, it's not because you just want to. It's because you feel compelled and you have to. And I felt incredibly and deeply inspired by Melville, the world that Melville created, not just the characters, but the language he uses, the sort of free improvisation of the book. But there's a real sense of a special universe that book inhabits, and I felt really inspired by it. It was Terrence McNally's idea to do it, and unfortunately he had to withdraw halfway through, but Gene Shearer and I have been working together to, you know, sort of try to distill essential stories from the book into something that will work on the stage as theater and also will work well as music theater in the opera world. And it's just been an inspiring, amazing project. So I've been inspired by it for years, of course, but the opportunity to do it has been amazing, a real privilege to sort of live immersed in that world.
You might have heard what Nathaniel Philbrick said earlier about the universality of the book and musicians being drawn to the rhythm of the sea. Is that true for what you're creating for the Dallas Opera?
I think it's also the sense of it's innately operatic itself. It's almost, if you think about Wagner and The Ring, there's a mythic quality to Moby Dick, and the characters are so larger than life and clear. And it's a story of love and death. It's a story of redemption. It's a story of obsession, salvation and damnation. It's all those big emotions and big themes that we really love to explore in the opera world, with things that are large enough to fill an opera house and make sense for people to sing rather than just speak. But I think it's that sort of mythic quality, that epic quality that really inspires people too, and that world where literally we are all individually floating at sea, but Melville has an entire universe floating on the ocean with the vastness of we don't know how far we're looking up above or what's there, and we don't know what's below or how far down it goes. And so we're literally floating in middle ground on the water. And I think all of that is inspiring to musicians, and there's so much that's unknown, and yet it's that eternal quest that people have to sort of try to control nature and tell the waves which way to crash and tell nature how it's supposed to work rather than how it does work, and trying to think that we know everything when we actually know nothing. It's just so incredible what Melville managed to capture in that book.
That's the composer, Jake Heggie. I want to read both of you, Jake and Nathaniel, a comment that came in our website from someone who calls himself Mozo from New York City. It's sort of a long comment, but basically the listener is pointing out that the book Moby Dick is one of those books that is looks a little bit better on your bookshelf than is to read. And Mozo asks, how many of these musicians have actually read the book, and not just cheated and seen the movies. Nathaniel, I want to ask you, I'm going to disclose something right now. I've only read half of Moby Dick, and I gave up. It's really kind of it can be an impenetrable book. How do you get through it, and why should people move to the end?
Well, you know, it is one of the great doorstops of history, but it also is a book that, you know, once you get into it, once you get into that, if the myth, mythic quality that Jake's talking about stirs you at all, it can really become a kind of obsessive thing. And, you know, I mentioned the Bible earlier, and, you know, I've read it a couple of times, but what I enjoy now most is just picking it up and dipping into a random part and then losing myself for as much time as I have and then surfacing and then going on with my life. And you know, I don't know. I can't speak for any musician, you know, how they connect with it. But I think that there is so much. It is a universal story, a timeless story. There's just so much metaphoric content there that, you know, it'll grab you in some way if you give it a chance.
Well, I want to toss this over to Jake. You're the musician of the bunch. What are the juiciest parts of the book that you've been able to mine for the opera that you're writing?
You know, it's these connections that happen. Ishmael starts off as this lost soul, and he winds up being the sole survivor. You know, he finds redemption somehow, and he's allowed to be the one that lives to tell the tale.
Spoiler alert.
And then there's this wonderful conflict between between Ahab and Starbuck, who are very alike. And as you read it, I mean, there's this amazing language that's given to these characters, especially to Ahab. Just this phenomenal poetry that holds its own with Shakespeare, with any of the beautiful poetry that you can think of. And I think one of the secrets of the book is you have to give yourself over into that sense of time that it uses. It's like if you go to Wagner's Ring, if you go to any opera, if you go to a play that's epic in length, you have to forget about real time and let yourself go into the time of that world. And if you do that and sort of lose yourself in it, it's a really rich, rewarding experience. I find the personal crises that the characters are going through enormously inspiring and interesting, and how Melville traces them. Like I said, it's almost like a theme with variations. There's this core story that's happening, and then we go up and down around it with Ishmael talking about different aspects of the world that he's in, of what whaling is, of what kinds of whales there are, all of this background information that people can get lost in. But if you take it as part of this whole timing and this sense of space and development that's happening, it's a really amazing, rich book. We don't have the same aesthetic, of course, these days as in terms of reading as they did in the 19th century. They didn't have TV and movies and all that stuff, so they wanted books where, you know, you were lost in a story the same way they could deal with, you know, 4 and 5 hour length operas, because there wasn't any other distraction. And so I think we're a little anxious these days when it comes to reading, but if you lose yourself in that world, it's remarkable. But I do call it sort of the great American novel that no one's ever read, you know.
people
lose patience with it quite quickly.
That's composer Jake Heggie. He and librettist Gene Shear are working on an adaptation of Moby Dick that'll be produced at the Dallas Opera in the spring of 2010. I'm also talking with Nathaniel Philbrick. He's the author of the book In the Heart of the Sea. Nathaniel, you've spent a lot of time with the culture of the sea, sea stories, and sea literature. Is music part of the book Moby Dick at all? Does it play a role in it?
Yeah, it really does. The sea shanties, several sea shanties are referred to throughout the book. You know, it's not a huge part of it, but, you know, when you can't talk about a whaler's life without the sea, because they were always singing these were work songs that were sung to just help them lift anchors and set the sails, and so that really, there is a musical texture to the everyday life that Melville's describing. And you know, and I just have to say the poetry of his prose is is so musical, is so Shakespearean, and yet Shakespeare through something that happened to him in the 19th century that it really is, there is a lyrical quality there that that really soars.
There's a sea shanty that's heard in the 1956 film version of Moby Dick by director John Huston. In this scene, the crew of the Pequod are preparing to set sail from Nantucket. They're pulling on ropes, which you'll be able to hear sort of cranking away, and they're singing a sea shanty and the line, "Heave away, me Johnny."
Heave away, my Johnny.
A scene from the 1956 film version of Moby Dick, directed by John Huston and starring Gregory Peck as Ahab. I'm talking with the composer Jake Heggie and the author Nathaniel Philbrick here on Soundcheck. I'm Joel Meyer in for John Schaefer. Jake and Nathaniel, we just have a couple of minutes, but Jake, you know, you told me last week that you finished the first draft of your opera on Thursday. When you're talking about finishing a first draft of something based on Moby Dick, how does that feel?
Oh, my God. It was an amazing sense of relief and a little bit of astonishment to think that that it actually exists. I mean, a year ago, there wasn't an opera based on, you know, by me anyway, based on Moby Dick, and now there is. And I feel very good about it. I think Gene found a wonderful way to distill the story, and we used a lot of Melville's original language in the telling of it, and it's awoken, I think, a new kind of musical language in me, which was incredibly rewarding and stimulating and challenging. But there's still a lot of work to do. We do a workshop in San Francisco next week where we read through all the roles, and then we'll make changes. Then I have to orchestrate the entire thing, and then we go into rehearsals in Dallas next year with our director, Leonard Folia, and Ben Heppner is going to be Ahab, and Stephen Costello is Ishmael, and really great cast, and
is
conducting.
Morgan Smith in that cast as well?
Yeah, Morgan is playing Starbuck.
Well, it's funny you mentioned that, because Morgan Smith is on the phone with us right now.
Morgan,
welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi there. Hello, Jake.
Or should I call you Starbuck?
Call me
Starbuck. Either will work, certainly.
Morgan, you've seen the score and heard a little bit of it. Can you tell us what you think of it?
Well, I haven't heard the score. Jake and I met when I was down in Fort Worth. It just looks like a glorious, glorious piece of music, an incredible piece of dramatic writing. And I'm really, really excited about it.
And what do you think about? I mean, how challenging is it to be Starbuck? Starbuck is a pivotal character in the book. He's sort of the sense of reason. How do you prepare for that role?
Well, certainly rereading the book was item number one on the list, and rereading it the right way. I don't know that I quite got through it in high school. But you're right. I mean, Starbuck is an incredibly pivotal character, obviously a foil for Ahab and Ahab's descent into madness, and representative of the crew and really the real source of morality on the boat itself, and I think it's going to be probably the most challenging role that I've ever taken on.
That's Morgan Smith. He's one of the cast members in the upcoming adaptation of Moby Dick that Jake Heggie and librettist Gene Shear are going to be they're in the middle of creating right now. It'll be premiered on April 30th at the Dallas Opera. To Jake and Morgan, both, thanks for calling in. And Nathaniel, I wanted to give you the last word here. We just have a couple of seconds, but a couple of people have pointed on our website how difficult it is to get through the book. Why should they get to the end?
Well, as you said in the spoiler alert, Ishmael is the sole survivor, and I think it's Ishmael's point of view that he grows into that is going to save the world if that's possible, and use that as a motivation. It's worth getting to the end because it's so powerful, and you'll be coming back if you can make it that far.
Nathaniel Philbrick is the author of the book In the Heart of the Sea, The Tragedy of the Whale Ship Essex. He also wrote a foreword to Moby Dick. Nathaniel, thanks for coming on Soundcheck. And thanks to Jake and Morgan as well, too. We'll leave you with this bit from a commenter on our website. Freddie posted this comment. Mastodon, the metal band, recorded an album of Moby Dick-inspired song cycles called Leviathan. And this is one of the songs. This is I Am Ahab from the Mastodon album Leviathan. You're listening to Soundcheck. Up next, we'll talk to a Brooklyn school teacher who's on a mission to turn each of Moby Dick's 135 chapters into songs. And then coming up later, this fiddle player, Kendall Carson, joins us to talk about writing songs with veteran tunesmith Chip Taylor. And they'll both play live in the studio. I'm Joel Meyer in for John Schaefer. This is Soundcheck.
Oh, baby, lie down next to me, next to me. No worries, no sound next to me. Come on down. I am naked.